Thank you. I hope you'll permit me to dress like you are, because it got hot here this afternoon, but with all that hot air, I wasn't surprised. I suppose when you see me get up again, you feel like the lady in the old story who went to the doctor with an obscure eruption on her skin, and the doctor puzzled over it, and finally he said, Madam, have you ever had this before? And she said, yes. He said, well, you've got it again. That's the condition you're in. You got it again. I hope you got all those problems solved this afternoon in your discussion sessions that I reported to you. I didn't create them, as I said. And no two people will ever diagnose. Doctors have strong one patient, but we got oftentimes very, very different interpretations of the finding. And that's the value of a conference, where you get all kinds of input and outcome. This afternoon I talked about the problems of peace in the world and the conflicts we faced around the world. Tonight I want at the beginning to say something about the conflicts here at home. We never had but one great internal conflict in our nation's history. That was 100 years ago. But it was on one front. How to end the institution of human slavery, human beings bought and sold, chattel, work animals, without destroying the Union. But now, as you well know, we've got conflicts on a dozen fronts. We've got conflicts on the economic front, the rich and the poor and so on. We have conflicts on the race front, not just the white and the black, the white and the black and the brown and the red and the yellow. We got conflicts on the family front. Who is to have the say in the home, the parents or the children? Or maybe some new pattern, different from what we've had. One day, one of my daughters, she was about 13, at a dinner table, she'd want something which we couldn't say yes to, explained it to her. She said in exasperation, Daddy, you're not democratic. I said, what do you mean? You think we ought to make these decisions by vote? Yes, this is a democratic country, and we make decisions by voting. Three of them and two of us. And, I said, my dear daughter, I'm afraid you got yourself kind of in a hole, because if the decisions are going to be made by voting in the family, the same as they were and were in the country, you can't do anything for the next 8 years. Till you're 21. Now it'd be five. And furthermore, I said, if the Lord had intended that you were to run us, he'd have given us to you. But he didn't. He gave you to us. And we'll always explain it, but there's some places where we've got to say no. And I learned that when they were asking for permission, half the time they were asking for limitations. They wanted to know where the fences are. They were relieved when we would take the responsibility. I remember one night this same girl, 3-4 years later, the phone rang, or some boy asked to talk to her, and she started in, and she was just gushing, oh, great, isn't that nice of you? And she began to wave to us, you know. Well, I'd love to, but I don't know whether my folks have got anything else planned or will let it do. And then covered it up and said, no. So I said, no. She couldn't go. And she said, doggone it, my old father won't say yes. And so, if I'm not willing the responsibility, I don't have any business having kids. We ask them to be braver in more difficult situations than we are. I remember adolescent revolt is a disease that comes to all youth. My generation. You hear them think it's the only generation that rebel. After World War I, we came home from the service and we were in rebellion. Stanley High wrote a book, The Revolt of Youth. We were just as rebellious as then. I remember my oldest daughter, she could hardly wait until she could go to college to get away from that old fuddy-duddy missionary father and mother of hers that didn't understand the younger generation and so on. And frankly, we were relieved when she went, because we didn't know what to do. She went away to college and came home at Christmas time, stayed at our house while she visited her friends. It was convenient and cheaper than any place else she could stay. And she came home at spring vacation, and we thought prayerfully maybe we could detect a slight mellowing of her attitudes. And then along about the 1st of May of her freshman year, we got a letter from her. Made us feel real good. It said only 4 weeks till school's out. I can hardly wait to get home. Now you see what had happened was this. You're always against the imperialism you know. I said today, if you've been under the British, they're against the British. If they've been under the Dutch, they go into the Dutch. If you go into Korea, you didn't find opposition to Western imperialism against the Japanese. That's the one they were under. Well, the only imperialism she knew was mine, and she was against it. But in college, she'd run into somebody else's imperialisms, the dean's or somebody's. And she decided the old man's wasn't quite as bad after all. And she came home voluntarily, rejoined our family, pretty much on her terms. But that was all right. That was all right. Her terms had moved along, you know. There's conflict, deep conflict in the family. No generation has all the answers, but you can't pretend it isn't there. And then there's conflict on the education front. Who is to determine what's to be taught, the scholars or the student? And the kids say, well, these courses aren't relevant. They're relevant to what? And they give you the things. They want education that's relevant for the next 3 years. But I said, sometimes say, I thought education was to prepare you for life, for anything that comes along. Not just for what's going to happen in the next few years. It'll be a difference. And they'll say, well, you fellows are behind the time. And I'm always glad to say, that's right. But don't worry, it'll only be 15 years and you're behind the times, I guarantee. The youth will always be in revolt against you. And when the 25-year-olds, come into office in these youth movements, I tell them, I sometimes ask them, did you have better judgment when you were 23 than you have now? No, I got better judgment now. And then you ask the 22, did you have better judgment when you were 20 than you have now? No. And they ask the 20s, did you have better judgment when you were 17 or 18 than you have now? No. But at the early stage, this is a human right. I was getting mad about it. It's a phenomenon that's a part of growing up. But it's more acute right now, partly, I think, because the ones that are older haven't taken the trouble to communicate, haven't explained. I blame ourselves more than the kids. 600 students at Columbia determined that 17,000 students were to be denied the education which they had entered into a contract with that university to provide them. Not the administration, but the students. Then there's a conflict on the age front, apart from the family. The youth are always restless. They're always against their elders. You see it. This is good. Out of it comes progress. Out of it comes incentives, new ideas. If they'll learn from the past and then put in the new, that's great. If we work with them, then there's conflict on the social front. Youth are always idealistic. They care intensely about poverty, disease, squalor, degradation, slums, lack of education or adequate health and so on. They're always dissatisfied with what is. Again, thank God. But they don't see what has been. They only see what is. They don't see what has been. They see what hasn't been accomplished, but they don't see, can't see, what has been accomplished. And they're frustrated with their parents because the parents see what has been accomplished. They'll say 15% of our people are poor. Awful. But they don't see that at the beginning of the century, by the same standards, 50% of our people were poor. And that maybe it's not too bad, a system's not too bad under which the people have been able to reduce the poverty from 50% to 15% in a period of 70 years. They're not wholly bad, but they don't see that. All they see, it's bad right now. But American youth, this is true of all youth, it's particularly true of American youth, because they've heard our boasts. Oh, we have said the difficult we Americans do today. The impossible takes a little longer. So the kids will say, well, if we can go to the moon, then we can abolish poverty, or we can abolish discrimination, or we can abolish prejudice right now. Anything that they want and that's good can be done right now. But of course, it isn't so. And we haven't explained that to them. It's one thing to go to the moon. You're dealing with absolutely predictable forces. Everybody wants to go to the moon. There are disagreements as to how to get there. But if you find the right answers, you can get there because everybody wants it. You're dealing with atoms, and the atom always acts in exactly the same way under the same circumstances. But when you're dealing with prejudice and so on, you're dealing with human beings. And no two human beings act exactly the same way under the same circumstances. We said this afternoon, one says yes, one says no. He can go against history, he can go against reason, he can go against the counsel of his friends and just say, this I won't do. It's relatively easy to move mountains. It's impossible to move prejudices in people's minds without their consent. These two are kind of like saying an apple and a banana are the same. No, they're not. Our youth have been loud or led or taught to believe if we can do one, we can do the other. And then when they don't succeed, it must be because the system is bad or the establishment is selfish and should be abolished. Of course, most of them don't want to abolish. They're not against any establishment. They just want to be the establishment right now. Somebody hasn't taught them that those who were in the establishment mostly got there by effort. I heard a candidate for the presidency in the campaign 1968 say on television, said, you can't blame our youth for being frustrated. He said, they're like a lad who stands in front of a vending machine and the candy bar doesn't come out. But he forgot to mention that the kid hadn't put the dime in yet, you know. Hadn't put the dime in. Got to come out right away. What does he go to school for? In partly to learn how to get the dimes to put in. And then there's conflict on the work front, the job, the farm, the factory, the marketplace, where we produce or distribute goods or services. And we do it for a profit. No, we do it, first of all, to produce some good or service that somebody wants. Because there won't be any profit if it isn't something that somebody wants. The first thing you're trying to do is meet a need. Sometimes the need is contrived a little bit. But still, you're trying to meet a need. And if you're able to meet that need for this good or service, people pay you for it. And you're able to provide for yourself and your family. But nevertheless, looking at just the profit, it's something evil. Youth, normally they have wanted, in most previous generations, they wanted to get a better life than they had. They wanted to break away from the traditional in order to improve their lot. But now, many are pretty comfortable because their parents have worked hard. These kids haven't gone through a depression. And I hear them say, well, my dad, he just is a money grubber. He goes down, he's a slave to that blamed office. It's a kind of a little sordid or unworthy to work the way the father works. And then the father wonders why the boy doesn't try harder to get ahead economically and so on. I don't think that's hard to understand. A thing is precious in proportion to its scarcity. We want what we don't have. Why should they try to become affluent? They are affluent. You made them so. Why should they work for affluence? They work for something else. They take this for granted. Now, this is the result of miseducation. Youth are what they've learned to be in home and school and church. And I just have to say that all three of these have failed their responsibility this generation in an unusual sense. There are many reasons for it. I can't take glance. The basic error is, however, that this generation of youth largely has been allowed or taught or encouraged or led to believe that self-support, conscientious work, personal responsibility are no longer necessary or even good. Science, automation, technology are going to guarantee adequate commodities and services, give economic security and without too much struggle. And if they don't give it, then the government will do it for us. And if the government doesn't, then it's due again to that selfish establishment. I heard a self-described hippie. I was riding in my car and had the radio on, and he was being interviewed. He called himself a hippie. He said, I don't know why people are against us. He said, we're not against anybody. We don't hate anybody. I just wish they'd leave us alone. I just wish they'd let us do our own thing. Why aren't they willing to let us be free? That's all we want, is to be free. And he had had his guitar and played a little ditty on it, which had about five variations of We Want to Be Free. And it was wistful and plaintive and moving. But I wish the guy who was interviewing him at the radio station would have asked one simple question. Sir, have you found a way to get free of the need to eat? Is there some way you can get free from eating? Because if you can't, then somebody has got to limit their freedom in order to work. And if you aren't willing to limit your freedom to work to produce what you have to eat, you're asking other people to limit their freedom so you'll have something to eat. Now, I didn't blame that kid. He'd been brought up to believe that there's some never-never land where you don't have to work. Just be free. Well, I said this one time, and a man came up after he said, "Why, you're against your own scriptures. Didn't Jesus say, look at your father, he takes after the birds of the air?" I said, "Yeah, but he didn't. He makes it available, but he doesn't drop it in the nest. Doesn't drop it in the nest. The birds got to go out and dig it out of the ground, or out of the bark, or out through the snow. He makes it available. Jesus said, seek and ye shall find. He didn't say, sit down and somebody will bring it to you. No, that's what the government says. Now, this confusion is here. You can't duck it. But I just feel that my generation, we've been so busy. I heard that we haven't taken time for this. I heard Dr. Hayakawa, this American of Japanese ancestry who pulled San Francisco State together when it was a shambles. I heard him say this summer, the thing that worries me, he said, more than anything else, is this great question. How does a boy in America today become a man? How does he become a man? How does he grow up? In almost every society in the past, there were tests of manhood. Even the so-called pagan civilizations, the American Indian and others, they had tests to which they put the kid. He had to ride this, or he had to suffer this pain without a word. And when he was able to, he was accepted as a man. He proved himself. Dr. Hayakawa says, outside of athletics, it still is true in athletics. You got to deliver, or you aren't on the team. But outside of that, how does a boy become a man? My boys get in trouble, and I say to them, what kind of a family do you have? Well, I don't know. What's your father do? I don't know. You mean you don't know what your father does? Well, he's an insurance adjuster, but I don't know what he does. I grew up on a farm down here in Nebraska. I knew what my father did. I worked alongside of him. And when I could pitch bundles, and when I could shock wheat, and when I could drive the harvester, and some the way a man could, and I could do it at 16, I was accepted as a man. These kids they don't have a chance to know what their father does. They spend most of their life with women. How does a boy become a man? No wonder he's frustrated and lashes out. Outside of athletics, he doesn't have a chance to achieve and have the satisfaction that comes from accomplishment. And there's conflict on the political front, the state. For 700 years, beginning with Magna Carta, our forefathers fought to reduce the powers of government so people could have these powers. They took some powers away from King John, and other powers away from King George, and other powers away from the landed gentry and the blue bloods and the aristocracy and the elite so people could have them. And now we've just busted our neck to turn them all back to the government after fighting 700 years to get them. Too hard to figure these out. The government should take care of this for us. It's an incredible paradox. Never was there so much distrust of government, and never were there so many demands for the government to take over the management of this. This government, which you can't trust, and is all full of inefficiency, but it must set up an agency to do this and an agency to do that. Demands such as we never had before. Somebody hasn't put two and two together. Our forefathers set up a system where the kind of government could be determined by themselves at the ballot box. That was the essence of it. Before they got off the Mayflower, they sat down, as I said, and established this, agreed to limit their freedom to have a government. But they defined what it was able to do. And our forefathers, when they went further along the next step, wrote the Constitution, they put on a lot of the states wouldn't have accepted it without the Bill of Rights, which is a list of guarantees that the government will do this, that, or the other for the people. No, no, no. Every last one of them is a guarantee that our government cannot do this, that, or the other to the citizen. Rights are what your government cannot do. And it spells them out, the powers that are given. They were so careful not to let these precious powers be given back that our forefathers had fought so hard for. They establish rule by the majority, but not all rule. That's the point. Not complete rule. There were minority rights. That's what the Ten Amendments were about. Minority rights that the government couldn't do. If you had 99% of the votes, you still can't pass the law regarding an establishment of religion. Still can't quarter troops in your home in time of peace. Still can't deprive you of life, liberty, or property, right on the same basis, and they should be, without due process of law. It was the limitations that placed on government that was the unique thing. But there are some, if they can't get their way at the ballot box, never mind, advocate bombs and bullets. And if the government resists that lawlessness, then it's a fascist government repressing the right of dissent. And of course that again is sloppy or no thinking at all. It isn't repression of the right to dissent, it's a repression of violence to preserve the right to dissent. So I can dissent. If I've got a chance to put out my ideas in the marketplace and can't win a majority to them, should they then prevail? A lot of our kids have been brought up to believe that one of the minority rights is minority rule, and that ain't so. You've got to have some means by which you come to power. And if it infringes on the right to speak and to assemble and peaceably to petition and the whole list of it, then you have to use violence. Our forefathers were denied, our British ancestors, our colonial forefathers who were British citizens, they were denied the rights that other British citizens had. That was the only possible justification for their violent revolution. If I've got the same rights everybody else has and I can't persuade a majority, should my ideas then prevail? I said this at a college one day, University of Texas, and one of the girl students said, "Oh, you think the majority's all right?" I said, "Lord, I hope not, because if it is, I'm in a mess. I've been in the minority almost all my life." You've got to have a means of governing. Well, there's then all these conflicts on the moral front. I spoke of one of those this afternoon, just one word about it. No one denies there's an astronomical order. Our men wouldn't have started 1 foot, those astronauts, toward the moon if they hadn't been absolutely certain there is a totally predictable, dependable astronomical order. What they go out to do is to try to find more about it. We don't know. But they're not out to create the order. When Newton, studying the behavior of falling bodies and had an apple hit him on the head in a flash of insight, perceived the law of gravity. He didn't invent it. He had been around there quite a while. He perceived it. Now, no one says we must create a chemical order. We must create a physical order. Our generation must create a biological order for our times, you know. No, there's been one created for all times. And yet a whole generation is increasingly saying that there is no moral order, and therefore we must create a moral order for our times. A new morality, they call it. Generally, it's the same old immorality that's come up in every generation. But it's called a new morality. Now look, is it conceivable? Will a mind that's been created so that it can grasp the order that's in the universe, will it tolerate the notion that there has been created order in every single field except the most important order of all, the relation of people to people, which is the moral order? No order there? Our task is to create one rather than try to discover what it is and apply it more effectively in our time. And then there's conflict on the religious front. Our forefathers fought to make sure that the state couldn't run the church. But a lot of Christians are saying the church should run the state. Are the principles, values, laws of the Judeo-Christian faith, by insight, revelation, experience, as they've been developed and passed on to us, are they relevant to our times? I wonder how many, if I can ask you at this point, how many of you attended the governor's prayer breakfast in about 3 years ago in Denver where I spoke? 1, 2, 3, or 4, or 5. Because there are a couple of things I said then, if you don't mind, I want to say tomorrow, if you don't mind about it. Because they're in this very field. What are Are God's laws, are there laws that God has created in this field? And if so, what are they? And are they relevant to our time? Or is God dead or never was? That is, gentlemen, we are faced here at home, not with just a departure from accepted standards. That's happened in every generation. Nobody, including you and me, lives fully up to the standards that we believe in. But we're aware of our shortcomings, and we are not happy about our shortcomings and strive constantly to come nearer to the standard. But the rejection that's most alarming today is an attack upon the standards. Millions of people are saying, in whatever field, that the standards aren't necessary today, or they aren't necessarily good if you do live up to them. Now, here's where we're coming in the conflicts and confusion here at home. What is the role of religion in a world of such conflict here at home, such confusion, uncertainty? What can we do about it? Well, I think the first thing is we have to study, just as we tried to study and examine the patient. Kaida comes with some diagnoses in the international field, so we have to study how this happened here at home. Our forefathers came here, almost all of those original ones, because they were determined to have religious liberty. And they had discovered that you couldn't have religious liberty unless you had political liberty. So the Pilgrims to New England, and some of the Dutch to the Hudson Valley, and the Quakers to Pennsylvania, and the Catholics to Maryland, and the Huguenots, the Carolinas, they came here to get political liberty, so they could have religious liberty. How were they going to do it? They didn't have any blueprint, precedent. All the rest of the world was run from the top down. Kings, governors, landed gentry, aristocracies, hereditary kings, etc. But their minds were clear. And they established a system which, for the first time on a major scale, provided government from the bottom up rather than the top down, where the people control the government instead of the government owning the people. That was the essence of it. And, of course, it worked. It released the creative capacities that were in people of all walks of life. In the old countries from which our forefathers came, if a boy's father was a carpenter, he became a carpenter. And his son became a carpenter, or a cobbler, whatever it was. My, what the world was deprived of during the centuries when the boy just followed his father. Here was a boy who had the capacity to become a great musician, and there was a one to be a mathematician, and there a scientist, and there an inventor. And he just did what his father did. But our forefathers set up a system where you had a better chance than ever before to make the most of what was in you. And what happened, of course? It was revealed that on people of all races, all backgrounds, all climates and cultures, there was incredible genius. It was released, and there took place in America the greatest outburst of creative effort, imagination, energy, invention, production, progress that the world has ever seen. And this is how we got where we are. We don't have different chromosomes, genes from other people. We don't have greater resources. The rest of the world has got enormously greater resources. It was the religious concepts that were at the foundation. Political liberty so they could have religious liberty. And then they discovered they had to have economic liberty, because without economic liberty and some economic base, you couldn't defend the other. I told you this afternoon, Marx says the abolition of private property, dictatorship of the proletariat. That's not gibberish. That's scientific, they'll tell you. Why should they want to have government dictatorship of the proletariat? Why? Proletariat means people without property, people who sell their labor for wages, because it's easy to control people without property. Easy to control people without property. If you haven't got a chicken or a pig or a little garden or some vegetables or some savings, how do you stand up against the tyrant? You can't. Can't get a ration card. It's easy to control people without property. A lot of people will talk about property rights and human rights. And human rights are noble. Property rights are unworthy. They haven't done much thinking, gentlemen. Property doesn't have right, but the right to own property is absolutely essential if you're to have the other rights. A man who'll walk into a machine gun in time of war and give his life without hesitation will, if the only way he can get a ration card for his and wife and kids is by signing on the dotted line, will probably sign on the dotted line. They've thought about these things and worked at them harder than we have in many, many ways. So I somehow feel we've got to rediscover the religious foundations out of which these institutions and the values and the results which are so remarkable have come. And adjust them, yes, but the basic things are still there. Have to study. What is the business of religion in the broadest sense, our religion? Well, I think you can put it in lay's language this way. The business of the Christian religion is to meet the needs of people. Well, what are the needs of people? The needs of people are to be prepared for life. What part of life? All of life. Work and play and love and worship. And life where? Where they are. Where is a person mostly? At home and on the job. That's where it's to meet his needs. Those are the two places where he's most of the time. Home and on the job. And if his religion doesn't help him on the job or help him at home, then it's not good enough to have it on Sunday. Of course not. It's to meet the needs of people. What people? All people. All people. I talked to one of you, some of you this afternoon, something I heard Bishop Sheehan saying, Archbishop Sheehan, Fulton J. Sheehan. He and I were on one of these interfaith programs, and I was representing the lay Catholics, and he was the president, Protestants, and he represented the Catholics. And he said something that I don't know how you can miss. You know, when these things, these insights come, you wonder, why didn't you think of that before? He said, you know, my ministry's been divided into three main stages or phases. The first, we're right. I contended for it. The second was, they're wrong. And then he said, one day, out of the scriptures, something hit me that had been there all this time, I'd never perceived it before, that helped me see. I saw in a flash that this was important, but not the most important thing. The most important thing was not whether the person's right or wrong. It is that God loves you, whether you're right or wrong. And he said, what did this come out of? When I was reading the Testament where Jesus spoke of it, his Father, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I've read that a million times. And I, first time I thought about it. Who was Abraham? He was a giant. He was a great man. He was a man of faith. He was a man of willingness to follow his faith. He went up not knowing whither he went. God is the God of the great. The God of Isaac. Who was Isaac? He was a zero. He didn't amount to anything. He couldn't even bring up his kids for what they were quarreling, fighting among themselves. The only thing he did worthy to mention is that he allowed his father to put him on the brush to burn him. What could he have done? God's the God of the failures. And then Jacob. Who was Jacob? Bishop Sheehan said. He was a crook. He was a poor, straight scoundrel. God never gave up on him. Never gave up on me. He was the God of Jacob too. And all of a sudden I discovered this is the great thing. He loves us all. Whether we're right or wrong, he still loves us. And he doesn't give up on us. Doesn't give up on me. Doesn't give up on you. And I went home, and that same week I had a grandchild just learning to walk. And I never thought of it before. This was the sixth of my grandchildren. And I walked along with her, and she stumbled and fell over. I didn't get mad and bawl her out because she didn't walk. I picked her up, and we walked on. And she fell down again, and we walked on. She learning to walk. And I suddenly saw, there, God. He doesn't blow up because I unworthily failed to live up to it. He said, oh, too bad, kid, you fell over, but he picks me up and gives me another shot. Come to another conference, gives me a new start. Never gives up on me. Never gives up on me. The God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, this insight is basic and fundamental. The business of the Christian religion is to help meet the needs of people. All people, all their needs. Where? Wherever they are. Here, abroad. Business, home, social life, religious work, and so on. Religion in the more limited sense. Well, then you have to conclude that whatever affects human beings must be a concern. The concern of a vital religion. And what affects human beings most nowadays? Is there anything that affects human beings more today than government? For reasons we've talked about several times. The ancient prophet knew this. You remember he said, is Jehovah pleased with your many religious exercises, your sacrifices and burnt offerings? Let justice roll down as waters and righteousness as a mighty stream. How do you get justice? Government. Government is justice is a function of government. Jesus said, you tithe mint and anise and cumin, and you neglect the weightier matters of the law. Justice and mercy. Not or. No. Not justice or mercy. Justice and mercy. Or, if you wish, justice with mercy. But still justice. Jesus said, I was in prison, and you came unto me. He didn't say you let me out. But you visited me. Justice required I stay in prison. Not soupy sentimentality. But there was mercy with the justice. And what else? And faith, he said. What? Faith that justice and mercy will prevail. Now that has to go into our whole society, our international relations, and here at home. And justice can only come in the long run as a function of government. So it seems to me it's inescapable that a Christian has to be concerned with efforts to get good government. And how do you get good government? Well, you start in and diagnose, examine the patient. I heard one of my political friends who also aspired to be the president of the United States. He's never been out in Vietnam, but he knows all the answer. I've said to him, you know, I was taught never to diagnose and prescribe for a patient I hadn't examined, at least once. The ones who know all the answers are the ones who haven't examined the patient. That you got to study. International, we talked about this happening. We got to study these domestic ones here tonight and all the time. Then the question promptly comes, is there such a thing as a Christian position in political matters? Well, my answer on that is seldom a position that's fully Christian. And there's a reason for that. A lot of people, a lot of our church people, think the government should be a reform organization. The government should do what we think the reform should be. We Christians. But a government is not a religious organization. The church is. The government is not a reform organization. A government set up to keep people from hurting each other so each has the maximum. But its job is not to tell them. That's dictatorship again. What they should follow and so on. It's so difficult to keep from knowing the answers for other people. Now, we Christians, I think we know what's right. But there are a lot of people who are non-Christians. They're citizens. Their wishes, their views, not to be considered. There are a lot of citizens who are anti-Christian. They have exactly the same rights as I, a Christian. A government is not a religious organization. The church is the religious organization. East has its function and they're related. And a revival religion has got to have a concern for government. But it can't have the government do its religious work for it. And yet a lot of us are trying to do it. So it's seldom that there's a fully Christian position. But I think you could say that if there's a principle or a policy or a program that helps people more than the other principles, policies, and programs that are being advocated, it's a nearer Christian position. Nearer what we would think. I have one criterion in international relations to which by which I judge whatever proposal comes. It's this one. Where should our government stand, the government with our history? On the side of the oppressors or the oppressed? Just as simple as that. Where does America stand? With the tyrants or with their victims? That doesn't mean you have to go over and drop bombs. No, no. But where do we stand? Unequivocally, unashamedly. Jesus always stood on the side of the underdog, if you wish. He didn't start a war. He didn't start a rebellion against Rome. His people were in slavery. But there never was any question where his position was. That was the nearest to the Christian position. The answer in part to this question, is there such a thing as a Christian position, depends on what you regard as good for people. What kind of government is best? That which does most for people directly? Or that kind which makes it possible by maintaining order and opportunity for most people to do most for themselves and then assist generously, I would say fully. Don't give them half of what they need. Give them all they need, those who need help. But because some need help, I don't know why you should give help to people who don't need help. The net result being most of the aid goes to people who don't need help, and there isn't enough for the people who do need help. I was at a conference of students, And they were talking about this question of the individual in a mass society. Everything's now being done for him, but the individual loses his sense of identity and responsibility, he went on and said. One of the kids got up and he said, I come from Illinois. My family feeds livestock. He said, we can take steers and put them in the feedlot and get them fat. And he said, I suppose that's all the steers want, and they're perfectly happy if they're fat. But he said, I don't want to be a steer in a feedlot. That's the point. Is it just make people fat? Or is there something else in man that without which in the end he can't live? I suppose the answer also depends on how you understand and interpret Jesus' teachings and example. For example, look at these temptations. The devil came to him and said, don't you care about the poor? There are hungry people here. You have the power to take stones and turn them into bread. Why don't you do it? You old reactionary, hard-hearted, won't take care of the people. They got to go out and work themselves to do it when you could take care of them. Now, you see, Jesus, he always depended upon the situation, very practical. He did use his supernatural powers a couple times when his friends got too far from home without their bread baskets or adequate bread baskets. But when the devil said to him, you can help these people, he was tempted. Oh, how he was tempted. 40 days and 40 nights he wrestled with it. But in the end he said no. He had taught his disciples to pray every day. The only thing he taught them to pray for every day specifically was this bread. Can't live without it. But when it came to solving their bread problem for them, meeting their needs in the food field on a permanent basis, he said no. Why? Because it doesn't feed the spirit, and man can't live by bread alone. He can't live without it. Let me tell you, the hardest temptation I had as a member of Congress was this. For 20 years, I was one of 535 people in the United States who were given the power to turn paper into money. You don't care about the people. All you have to do is vote, and you can take care of these things. And you won't do it. All you have to do is turn paper into money. As long as it lasts. It's a temptation. Don't think it isn't. There's another temptation. The devil came to Jesus and said, now let's give and take. Let's negotiate. Let's have a conference at the summit. I can't find where Jesus sought out the devil, but he talked to the devil when the devil sought him. But he didn't give in. I'm nothing wrong with talking to the devil. I wouldn't pursue him and enhance his prestige, but I'd talk to him if he comes along. And what did the devil say? Now, let's give and take. What'll I give you? You can preach, you can teach, you can heal, you can go out and do your work of salvation. And these people need you. To whom else shall they go? Who else has the word of life except you? Now, what do you have to do? I'll give you the world. All you have to do is what? Don't let people find out who I am. Don't call me the devil. Call me an agrarian reformer. A Jeffersonian Democrat. A fellow who's really got a heart and cares about the reform. That's all you have to do. Don't call me the devil. Don't let the people find out until I got my hooks in. And then you can have the world to carry on your work. And he was tempted. I repeat, to whom were the people to go? Sheep without a shepherd. Who else had the word of life? And all he had to do to give in, and the devil would let him do these things, and if he didn't, there'd be a clash and he'd be eliminated. And again, he wrestled with it 40 days and 40 nights. But in the end, he said, no, that isn't the way. Now, these are the tough problems you're up against. You got to study them. Second, you must discuss them. That's what you have in your discussion sessions this afternoon. No two people get the same idea. You should challenge them. I hope you challenged what I said. I'm sure plenty of you did. Out of this comes cross-fertilization and ideas better than any of you had, perhaps, or any of us had at the beginning. And then what else do you have to do if you're going to work for good government to help meet the needs of people? You have to join a political party. Why? Because you want good candidates. It's run by people. The government's run by people. You want good officials, don't you? Well, how can you elect good officials if you don't first select good candidates? And how do you get good candidates except through a political party? Some of my liberal, some of my independent friends, they boast, I don't belong to any party. I'm an independent. I vote for the man. That sounds impressive, but it's very superficial. Because the only men they have a chance to vote for or against are the ones that the old parties, which they dread, which they scorn, dredge up. And then they have to go to the polls and vote for or against, in terms of which makes them hold only one side of their nose instead of both sides. That isn't much independent. That isn't much independent. Now, can you get a party that you'll agree with entirely? A lot of people say, do you agree with everything in your party? I sure don't. Is that not unique? You agree with everybody in your club? You agree with everybody in your business? You agree with everybody among your associates? Or even in your church? My wife's been married to me now for 39 years, and she still hasn't got sufficiently good judgment to agree. Has to agree with me on everything. You don't pull out of the business if you're making money because you don't agree. You don't pull out of your club because you don't agree. You stay in. It's the same with marriage. My wife told me on the last she's going to stay with me. Even though she doesn't agree on something, why is she going to stay with me? They're very practical. Let's be frank about it. She can't do any better at the present time. Ah, that's the essence of it. That's the essence of politics. You won't get anybody that you agree with entirely. I'm glad of that, otherwise you fellas would all want my wife. You never get anybody or any, I think they'll all agree. You pick out the party you think is nearest right on the most important issues and support it where it's right and then work from within it to try to change it. You can't change its position from the outside. Maybe within, sometimes you can. Not as much as you'd like, but more than you probably have a right to expect. Help select. Don't sterilize yourself and have no real influence if you don't help select, so you have a chance to help elect. And there again, you can never get anybody who's everybody's first choice. If I get my first choice, he's your third. If you get your first, he's my second. And some people say, well, I didn't nominate my choice and I got nobody to vote for, so I feel sorry for myself. Well, may I suggest a sensible thing to do if you can't, if you don't get your first, second, or third, or even fourth choice, see if you can figure out who your last choice is. What's your last choice? What's the worst thing that can happen? Well, the only way you can avoid your last choice is to vote for second, third, or fourth. I'd vote for the lesser evil to avoid the greater evil. We do this in medicine. Sometimes we don't know what to do for the patient. So we say, what's the worst thing that could happen to him? He could die. Don't let him die while we try to think up what to do. Why don't we have as much sense in politics and government as we have in our ordinary life, the rest of the life? And then, what else? Once in a while, you have to run to be a candidate. You have to be willing to run. And this is tough. I can bear testimony. I was reasonably respectable, even in my hometown, as long as I was a surgeon. And when I agreed to run for office, one of my best friends wrote to me and he said, Walter, what are you giving up your missionary work for? And I wrote, I'm not giving up my missionary work. I'm just changing my field. From China to Washington. It's needed worse in Washington right now. And I've driven out of China, and there isn't going to be a chance for any missionaries to be in China if we don't get some policies changed in Washington. We didn't get them changed. And there are no missionaries in China. This is a mission field. I beg of you, don't consider going into politics as a career. Make good in your own career and be willing to sacrifice your career to go into public service. A public office, appointive or elective, as a service to your country. We ask your generation, my generation, we're asking this generation to go into the armed services, sacrifice their career, perhaps their lives, as a service to their country. Why should challenges to sacrifice for civilian service be less and less responded to than the challenges for military service? Now, that is, I'll summarize this by saying, I don't think it's the job of the church organization, as an organization, to speak for Christians. I resent it when somebody gets up and says the Presbyterians think this, or the Congregationalists the rest of them. It isn't so. It's the job of the church as an organization to speak to Christians. That's what I've been trying to do here. Not to speak for you, but to speak to you. Now, the minister's got the same right and the same duty as a citizen to make up his mind and to vote and to campaign. But he hasn't got a right to use the church for a political program, in my opinion. Not only because right and wrong, because it doesn't work. Not to tell them what they must think, but that they must think. My observation is that when the government does that, it's very, very ineffective. I could give you a dozen illustrations. They come up before Congress, and they're, what they're for is the purpose clause. I remember when a guy came in from my church who was a congregationalist, and the thing about I'm a congregationalist by heredity and choice and so on, and that means every congregation is a law unto itself. We don't have any creed. We don't have any minister creed. We've got congregations that are totally fundamentalist, and we've got some that are Unitarian. They don't have any creed. Every congregation, they come together, a gathered fellowship in terms of that which they feel most comfortable with, or which they feel will help them most. And this, we got a committee on social action, 24 fellas. And this guy came down there. The secretary of it testified before the committee. I was a member of it, and he was for this bill. It had 100, it was pitiful, really. He was for what it was supposed to do. I was embarrassed. Some of the other people finally asked him, who weren't congregationalists, had he read the bill? No, he hadn't read it. He knew all of what we should do. He was for, it was going to cure this evil. That's like saying, I want you to operate. I'll tell you where to operate. You got appendicitis, but it's looked better if you operate on the left side. No, the doctor's got to decide. The congressman got to have some of the say as to how it operates. What you want, yeah. But he's got to figure out that his whole time he's given to it. Oh, no. He told us what we had to do. He said that the 1,100,000 congregational Christians were for this. And when he got through, I finally said to him, is there anybody who can speak for all the congregationalists? And he said, no. He knew I was one. And I said, did the church ever have this in a plebiscite or a poll or anything? No. Well, where did this resolution that you're talking about come from? Well, it came from the Council on Social Action. How many people are in that? 24. What was the vote? It was 14-5. There were 19 there. I said, you spoke for 14 congregationalists. Not 1,100,000. Now, you see, this damage, he downgraded the church. It was trying to do a political party's job, and it's not a political party. It wasn't doing its basic, far more essential thing. In summary, I am against political action by Christian bodies. I'm for political action by Christian persons. The preacher's got the job. The layman's got the job. You and I got the job to get into politics because we're Christians. And it's been my observation, the best way to make the Christian gospel effective in government is not by public pronouncements or pressures by church bodies. It is by persuading Christian men and women to become politicians. Now, you also ought to try to get politicians to become Christians. That'll probably be pretty hard. You ought to try it. But the real way to be effective is to get Christians to become politicians. And it's brutal. And you say, I don't want to take all that. Well, who does want to take it? The boys out in Vietnam don't like it, but we send them over there. I don't think I've got any excuse not to be working just as hard. Now, one more question. Can one be in politics and remain a Christian? Yes. Can one be a dedicated, faithful Christian and be successful in politics? Sometimes yes and sometimes no. But that's not unique. Let me tell you that the temptations or tests in political life are no more severe than those men face in other callings. I told you about the chemical manufacturer this afternoon. His obligations to his workmen, his obligation to his company, his stockholders, and his obligations to the well-being of the country and his own boy. I know a young idealistic chap who went to the law. He cares intensely about things that are wrong, and he works for a big firm. And he had to work at the grassroots and carry the briefcase of the greatest trial lawyer in that part of the country. He was privileged to have it. But he was frustrated 2 or 3 years because he couldn't get into court. And he got into court and his first case, and I saw him after it. I said, how'd you come out on that case? He said, oh, I won it. I got the fella acquitted and he's just as guilty as hell. That boy's suffering. He went into the law to get justice. And yet he created injustice following the principle that's better to have 10 convicted, acquitted, 10 guilty, acquitted, than one innocent, one convicted. So he used all the technicalities he got him on. He knew himself the man was guilty. And what's he going to do? And no politician's got any deeper temptations than that, gentlemen. And they haven't got any greater temptations than in journalism. You've got to get the story, no matter what it does to human beings. I could give you illustrations of that. People say, well, we have a right to know. No, there's some things you don't have a right to know. Just recently, I happened to be in Vietnam at a time when there were some very, this is a year and a half ago, right? Not recently, I have some very important negotiations going on, and the New York Times came out with its lead story about some things that Ambassador Bunker was taking up with President Thieu. And it said Ambassador Bunker has warned all of his staff they must be so careful not to let this information be out, because it'll fail if it's leaked out, because Thieu can't go along. If it's clear, he's just jumping to our whip. So the New York Times has its lead story. In order to make sure our policy will fail, nevertheless, the journalist's got to get the story. How does he get ahead in his work if he doesn't get the story? Sometimes, you know, there's a bad pun. Sometimes I think a lot of truth in it. It says in the Bible, Zacchaeus was unable to see the Lord because of the press. Bad pun, a lot of truth in it. You can't keep the government on the line without a press, but you can't. Who's going to keep the press on the line? Who's going to be the conscience for them? People say, well, the people have a right to know. Well, President, why didn't he tell us all the details? I wish he didn't tell all the details that he did. He announced he were going to send troops into Cambodia, a brilliant stroke. They were absolutely demoralized. I talked this week to one of the newspaper men. They hadn't expected it. They were going in all directions and getting north, trying to get out of Laos back to Vietnam. And then he announced we were only going to go 45 miles, so they went 46 and sat down and reorganized. And we're going to get out on the 1st of July. I don't know why. I have never yet told a patient I guarantee to finish this operation in 25 minutes, and if I'm not through, I won't even bother to sew you up. My job is to get the patient well, whether it takes a few days more or less. But the minute he says, July 1st, we're going to get out, who cares whether we succeeded or not? It's only whether he got out or not on July 1st. That's what he promised. I come from Minnesota, where we have wonderful football fans, and I've never heard the fans demand that our coach go on television on Friday night and diagram all the plays he plans to use on Saturday, so we, the fans, can follow the plays more easily in the game we now will lose. You don't have a right to know all these things in the process. When the decision's made, it has to be submitted to you. That's right. But you can't negotiate in private. Woodrow Wilson made that great mistake. His slogan was, open covenants, openly. You can't negotiate in public, I should have said. His slogan was, open covenants, openly arrived at. Now, they must be open covenants, but they cannot be openly arrived at. Do you negotiate with your labor people or with your boss in public? I'll bet when you were negotiating with a certain lady to persuade her to throw in her lot with you, it was not in public. Everything important has to be worked out privately. And then you negotiate. Boy, are you announcing? She said yes. But the negotiation has to be in private. Neither side can make a concession. If this side makes a concession public, why, the hotheads tear him to pieces. And if this side makes a concession, but if you get it agreed and come out and said, did you get? Yeah, but we got that. You give up on that? Yeah, but we got this. You see, you can't do it in public. And yet the law of journalism is get it out in the public, whether it destroys the cause or not. I couldn't be a journalist under this standard. Temptations are the same, in essence, to put expediency ahead of a principle. Temporary success ahead of the long-range standards. In politics, it takes the form of trying to please the people, to do what the majority seems to clamor for, to reflect what it seems the majority wants, or the most politically potent group will want, register what their views are, not what their views ought to be. I can give you a sample on example of this. In 1958, at the end of my 16th year in Congress, the labor people in the city of Minneapolis, I had a district which was substantial. When the farmer laborites and the Democrats are split into two parties, we can win. And I got in and got 6 years there before Mr. Humphrey got them together. I couldn't have won without those 6 years in which I'd been able to get a kind of a following, so I could win, even though the total vote for other candidates generally, after they got them together in 1948, was greater than the Republicans could get. And so the labor people came to see me in 1958. They always come in every year, and you appreciate that. The agricultural people come in and tell you reviews. You learn from that. You're dealing with things in which you're not expert, and they'll give you ideas. You may not agree with them, but at least you know what you're disagreeing with or what you're agreeing with. They're very helpful. They always come a couple times a year. These are the four bills that we're interested in. These two are bad. We want those licked, and those two we want. And you go back and forth with them. Well, they did this for the regular thing, and then when they got through, the state president of the AFL-CIO, a fellow named Bob Olson, he said, Judd, I'm not too much against you. Of course, he said, we don't like some of your votes. It looks to us as if you're in the pockets of big business some of the time. But you never were anti-labor. You're not one of the guys trying to gut the unions. He said, if you could see your way clear to go down the line with us all the way, we won't put anybody up against you, and you can stay there just as long as you want, and you won't have to go to all this trouble every 2 years getting reelected. Just as blunt as that. And I bristled. Then I saw he didn't see anything that was wrong with that. After all, they had the majority. Shouldn't they call the tune? I said to him, as soon as I cooled a little bit, I said, Mr. Olson, you just got through saying you thought I was in the pockets of big business part of the time. Now you've asked me to get into the pockets of labor all the time. Apparently you don't object to my being in somebody's pocket, just as long as it's your pocket. No, thank you, I'm not going to be in anybody's pocket. And why wouldn't you want me to be what my title is? What's my title? Delegate of the CIO? Or delegate of the Chamber of Commerce? Or delegate of the American Medical Association? Or delegate of the University of Minnesota? Or delegate of the church to which I belong? No, my title is United States Representative. I'm a member of the Board of Directors for 2 years at a time of the greatest corporation in the world. My mandate is to govern. And then come back and submit the record to you. If you think I've done a good job, you keep me in. If you haven't, then you should replace me. I think my job is not just to reflect what the majority is. My job is to be a window as well as a mirror. And my job, I've given full time to it. You maybe have 15, 20 minutes, 30 minutes a day to study these and study your union papers. You pay me enough so I can give my full time to it. I ought to know a little bit more about it. I come to a conclusion, I come home and explain it to you. And if I don't come home and explain to you why I voted, if I do and you don't agree, then you should replace me. But as long as I'm the doctor, I decide. You don't have to choose me. You can get another doctor. But as I use this illustration. You're wanting me to be like the flag on the cash register. And you boys up here have a conference, and you push the I button, and I vote I. And you push the no button, and I vote no. No, no. No. Don't you see, Mr. Olson, if I... Not Carl. Bob. Bob Olson. I said, don't you see, if I would get into your pockets, I'd get into the other people's pocket if they raised the ante. Well, you see, now, there's a fundamental difference of philosophy. Hell hath no fury like a labor leader scorned. I won by a bigger majority that year than I'd ever had. And the next year, 60, I won by a still bigger majority. But they won control of the legislature, both houses, in 1960, and they fixed up the district so the angel Gabriel can't run as a Republican in that district and get reelected. And I didn't feel bad about it. That's part of the game. They did it their way. If they couldn't skin the cat this way, they did it that way. But I can live with myself. I failed as a politician and being reelected. But I was not called upon as a soldier to come back. I was called upon to do my duty. As a Christian, it's not necessary. It's not required of me that I succeed. It is required of me that I not be disobedient under the heavenly vision. But I repeat, the difficulties are no greater there than in every other field. How about this business of getting reelected? Because they say you can't save the nation if you don't get reelected, can you? Well, when I first went down there, one of my seniors said to me, Water, he said, you'll discover that there are times when you have to rise above principle. Now, he wasn't being cynical. He was merely saying, rise above it to get reelected, and then you get some seniority, then you can be effective. But I said, if you rise above principle to get reelected, will I stick by the principle when I get in? No, I'll explain it, but I'll go ahead and got to live with myself. On the other hand, it doesn't mean that you need to tell people all the time all you know. You have to have some sense of timing. Jesus was so skillful at this. He moved in and hit, and then he went out. And the disciples said, what are you running out for? The whole city's gathered together, and they want you here. And he said, let's go to the next villages also. He hammered, and then he withdrew. Like the communists. Thrust and pause. He had sense. And when he didn't have the answer, he evaded, if you wish. question of should you do this and that to Caesar. He didn't evade. He got to the heart of the matter, but he didn't challenge him. Let me give you a concrete illustration. Barry Goldwater is one of the finest men I ever knew, but he's the poorest candidate I ever saw. He had some sort of a hang-up that made him feel that if he didn't tell people everything he knew, he was compromising his principle and he was deceiving them. And I've been present when people tried to talk to him. I'll give you one illustration. I was one of the fellows that tried our level best to keep this fund from being overloaded so that it would be weakened and you might be deprived one day of the benefits you're looking forward to in your retirement. But no, he always had to go on and add. Of course, if I'd have been there in 1936 when it was originally enacted, I'd have voted against it. No. He couldn't be so dumb as not to know that the only thing the paper would say, Goldwater's against Social Security, although he voted for it 6 times. Once a couple of us were talking to him, and I said to him, Barry, you seem to think that when you get down through the pasture and you meet the bull, there are only 2 things you can do. One is to wave the flag in his face and challenge him to a duel, or else you're bowing down, sacrificing your principle before the bull. There's a third course. Just say, good morning, Mr. Bull, and walk by. Don't have the fight that day. You don't have to fight on every issue every day. No, Jesus was so practical. He said, a king goes out to war and he finds he's got 10,000 and the other guy's got 20,000. He takes him on. Don't be a sucker. You'll get clobbered. Maneuver. Jesus said this, remember? He said, what fellow goes out to start to build a house without sitting down and seeing whether he's got enough to succeed or not? If he goes ahead and he doesn't finish it, people laugh at him. He didn't think it was a good idea, some virtue to be laughed at as a silly person. Go through the scriptures and read it. He had such a magnificent sense of timing. He moved in when it was critical, and then he moved on and allowed it to incubate in time. He wasn't compromising his principle. We doctors don't tell our patients everything first time we find something bad. And we're not deceiving them. We're telling them as much as they can take. If you let them have it, what do? They go to some quack and deny themselves the good care if you lead them along. In fact, Jesus said to his own disciples, there's more to tell you, but you aren't ready for it. Now, he wasn't deceiving them. He had a sense of timing. And in politics, as much as anything, you don't have to deceive, but you don't have to go out and challenge everybody to a duel. Then there's this terrific hardest problem of all. When to support the lesser evil as the way to avoid a greater evil. We talked about that a little bit this afternoon. And the tourist comes along and said, war is wrong. This war is immoral. Therefore, got to get out no matter what the guy. Or all war is immoral. Now, the latter was much more justifiable than the former. My own local preacher is a young fellow about 32 and got real potential. He got up and he went down to Selma, Alabama, and paraded because there were people who were violating the law on equal rights down there in Alabama. And then the next year, he preached a sermon on the right of conscientious objection to individual wars. And the person has a right to put his judgment on this war against that. I said to him after, you were pretty upset about those folks down in Alabama who put their conscience, they thought that was a wrong law. And it was their Christian duty to violate that law. And yet you did this morning have counseled in this particular issue. A man should listen to his own conscience only against the law. And ask for immunity, of course, right off the bat. He looked at me, he said, gee, I should have talked to you before I made that sermon. I says, that's right, you should have. You see, he was setting himself up. Government is not a religious institution. Our government protects the absolute pacifist. I can understand his position. I wrestled with it after I came home from World War I and saw the thing lost, and I thought the war had failed. And I said, I'll never have anything to do it again. And I thought about becoming a pacifist. I won't kill. But I couldn't accept it in the end, because I got a solution for my problem. I don't kill. But I didn't get a solution for society's problem. I walked off the field and my place was taken by somebody who would kill more. And that, if I kill, that's on my body. If I stand by and see millions more killed, that's on my body. If I operate and the patients die, my operation led to it. If I refuse to operate and the appendix ruptures and he dies, my refusal to operate, doing nothing, led to his death.
A decision not to decide is a decision, but there's much moral impact. I wrestled with this. They bring in a bill. If they let me vote 60% aye and 40% no, that would be easy. But I have to vote aye as if it's all good and some of it's awful. That's why I was hooked on. Or in order to kill this bad, I have to kill something that's been done, overdue, should have been done a long time ago. People say, how do you have the courage to do what's right? Then that's no problem. How do you know what's right? Is it 51-49? Here again, Goldwater, I'll give you a sample. The Civil Rights Bill of 1963 had 9 titles. There were 9 bills put together. 7 of them had to do with civil rights. The right to vote, that's a civil right. The right to own property, that's a civil right. The right to go into court and say, Judge, I think I've been wrong and I want redress, that's a civil right. But the right to take other people's property away from them to satisfy our social views is not a right. And it deprives other people of the right that is guaranteed them in the Constitution. Berry made a 5-minute speech, which is a classic, although I wouldn't have voted the way he did. He said, I took an oath here one day to support the United States, no. To support civil rights, no. To support any class of our people, no. I only took one oath. To uphold, support, and defend the Constitution of the United States. And yet 2 of those titles violate the Constitution of the United States. I can't vote for it. Even though all the things that are in those 7 we've done in our business in Phoenix, way ahead of any civil rights. If you separate them, then there's no problem. No, no. Now, I would have voted the other way. Why? I would have said, well, sure, those 2 are against the Constitution, but the failure to get these other things done are also against the Constitution. Lord, please don't look at my violating my oath on these 2 while we try to get something done about these others where there's been Constitution. See, you have to sweat on these things. I don't criticize others who come to different opinion from me as to where the majority is. I'll tell you, the thing that helped me most of all really was like the sun came out. It was something I ran across that Abraham Lincoln once said. He wasn't in office at the time, and my native state, Nebraska and Kansas, were getting their statehood, their territorial status. The question was slavery to be extended into them? And the purists, the William Lloyd Garrisons, the abolitionists, slavery's wrong, just like war's wrong. Therefore, of course, it must not be introduced. But Abraham Lincoln said, of course, it's wrong, but it's still a constitutionally proper and legal institution. Now, I hope the people of Kansas will vote against it, and I hope the people of Nebraska can vote against it. But how can the government move in and violate its own constitution? Because it's wrong. And then he had this sentence, magnificent. He said, much as I hate slavery, I would consent to its extension rather than see the Union dissolved. As I would, he said, consent to any great evil to avoid a greater evil. Who did most about slavery? The abolitionists who would have destroyed the Union, or Abraham Lincoln, who kept it together and was able to end slavery? And I said, oh boy, that helps me. I won't feel quite, if I come to convince this is bad, but it's, I'll do the lesser evil to avoid the greater evil. I didn't have this awful agony in myself trying to decide what to do. You see, the great temptation is to put faith in political solutions, and they're coercive, where in situations, many, where the real answer lies in personal solutions. Persuasion, conversion, if you wish, rather than coercion. And it's easier for a lot of our clergy to pass resolutions telling Congress what to do than it is to convince you tough laymen down there in the third row that you should go into politics to influence government. And they're frustrated. They can't persuade you and me. So, gee, they care. They're conscientious. And they have to work at the other end. Well, I've talked too long, haven't I? I'd just like to wind up with a verse of it. And then you start picking at the pieces. A verse that wasn't in the Battle Hymn of the Republic that was sung tonight. I thought of it. It's the one that I think applies most of all to what I've been trying to talk about. Where it says, he hath sounded forth the trumpet, which shall never call retreat. He is sounding, he is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat. Now what? This is the period in which we live, sifted out. Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him, the personal. Be jubilant, my feet, go to work. Our God is marching on. And it seems to me our task as Christian laymen is to find out where he is and march with him. Now, go ahead, and you got a chance to ask me some questions, and I'll try to answer them if I can. Go ahead.